You're listening to Barbershop Talks on WGXC 90.7 FM, Ankara, Catskill, Hudson.
And as night falls, we hide our sons from cold sidewalks and cold faces, pale faces, the faces that may not be able to directly relate. At night, we hug our sons' pillows and place them under our breasts, keeping them in front of our heart, praying that they will be able to pass the Arizona iced tea and Skittles phase. We sit in a daze, waiting by the window, all lights on, jumping at every move. We profiling every shadow. They all black. Waiting for that knock, that key turn at the door, hoping that it ain't dark uniforms with leading sirens. Hoping that our children's hoodies come back with a heartbeat. Hoping that the only walk down silent hallways lead to a kiss goodnight. Praying that tears run ashy trails only at graduation day. Praying that this ain't the end, not this way.
In the Circuit Court of the 18th Judicial Circuit in and for Seminole County, Florida, State of Florida versus George Zimmerman, verdict, we the jury find George Zimmerman not guilty.
July 13th, 2013 will now always be a day America, specifically Black America, will remember. On this day, George Zimmerman has been acquitted of second-degree murder and manslaughter after shooting dead a 17-year-old boy armed with a dollar iced tea and a bag of Skittles for looking suspicious. After calling the police and being told following him was not necessary, Zimmerman and Martin got into a scuffle in which Zimmerman's face was injured. Then Zimmerman shot Trayvon at close range once in his heart. Stand Your Ground states that a person can use deadly force instead of leaving a confrontation when one is in fear for their life. Trayvon Martin wasn't in fear for his life, being followed by a suspicious man who then gets out of his car to continue following the boy. The verdict is just an ugly reminder that times are getting worse, racism is alive and well, and we have a long way to go to achieve actual justice for our people. Mothers shouldn't have to fear that their child's walk to the corner store may be the last time they kiss them. A mother shouldn't fear that because her child is wearing a hood in the rain, he may be shot dead. This verdict, this whole case, cannot be ignored and should serve as an example to educate our children on the ills of the world they now live in. Where do we go from here? I want to thank everybody for being in the studio today. We have Kamal Johnson co-hosting.
Thank you for having me back.
Kenny, and we have Sarah.
What's up, y'all? It's good to be here.
Hi, you guys.
Angela Corey, Florida State Attorney, says this was not a case of race, but that Trayvon was profiled. What's the first thing that comes to your mind when you hear the word profile?
Race. I mean, you really can't have a case where someone is profiled and it not be about race, because he was suspicious because he was, you know, a young black male in a hood in that neighborhood. So in order to profile someone, it has to be about race.
Is there such thing as reverse profiling?
I wouldn't say, in my own opinion, like if you're profiling someone, then you already have a stigma that may not be true about that person.
I feel like profiling is just another form of prejudice, that you don't profile somebody unless you've already had a certain feeling about that person that you're profiling them as.
Can you predict if Zimmerman came to Trayvon's neighborhood just walking and Trayvon felt he was suspicious and followed him, what the outcome of that trial would have been?
In my opinion, I would think that he would be in jail. He would have been convicted. And a lot of times when there's, you know, violence in urban neighborhoods, they don't have a defense team to back them up, or they don't have, you know, a whole crew of people, of lawyers that can really get to the bottom of facts. You know, they can only afford what they can get. So a lot of times there's a lot of people wrongfully convicted in urban neighborhoods, and there's a lot of things that go unnoticed.
I don't really know how it would play out. Like, say likewise, like if I was in a predominantly black neighborhood late at night, I might have some certain, you know, thoughts about where I am, who I'm with. Like, it goes both ways, I guess. You just don't see about it too much that way because, like Kamal was saying, you know, it all falls back, I believe, on, like, money at the end. Like, proper legal team and representation, you can make a lot of stuff go away.
When you think about it in those terms, if you were on the jury, do you think it'd be possible to say that you could handle this case without thinking of race?
I feel if I was on the jury that he would have never been found not guilty because I couldn't have consciously voted not guilty in my heart.
Would you have not voted race plays a factor or because...
I would have just voted not guilty for the simple fact that after the phone call where the cop told him to stand down, everything that transpired afterwards is because of his... He made that mistake. They told him not to. To me, that's you did something wrong. You know, he said during the trial that his lawyer advised him not to testify, take the stand, and, you know, he listened then. You know, if he had listened to the cop that night, none of this would have ever even went down.
I have a thought. It just strikes me when you ask that question about, like, what it would have been to be on the jury, and that most of the questions that you've just asked so far were not actually conversations that were allowed to happen in the courtroom. Mm-hmm. So, like, all the stuff about Zimmerman's personal history, what about that was and wasn't found relevant to the case and wasn't allowed to be brought in. He had a really complicated past that wasn't allowed to be brought into the room. And same with, you know, really base, like, common sense conversations about race and profiling and, like, every conversation that's happening in our houses and on the streets, because it's like the reality that all of us know, because it's the system that all of us live in, no matter whether we're benefiting it from it or no matter whether it's marginalizing us. But I think what's so crazy is that our justice system doesn't allow those conversations that really represent our experiences to actually happen, you know, because it goes through legalese.
Mm-hmm. I have a question for Sarah and Kenny. Third and Down Street Hudson are predominantly black areas. Like, is there ever a time where you guys feel uncomfortable?
Me personally, no. I've lived here my whole life. I'm cool with, you know, a lot of people down there, and I've been down there a lot. But on the same note, like, there's a lot of different faces down there from, you know, years past when other faces were down there. And, you know, you don't know who feels a certain way towards you, you know. I just keep my cool and, you know, keep it moving.
Sarah?
It's an interesting question because I would say yes, I have felt uncomfortable, but not ever uncomfortable in that, like, I would feel unsafe. I think the kind of discomfort is more around, like, the kind, you know, when we're around people who look like us and we're around people who we've grown up with, people, there's a certain kind of comfort zone around that. And when you step outside of that and you try to spend time with people who have had, like, a different set of experiences, there's a certain kind of discomfort, which is, like, I think one of the healthiest feelings in the world. And I think that's a kind of discomfort that I actually kind of embrace. It's sort of like, wow, there are some real cultural differences here. And this is, like, this is the kind of, like, social interaction that it's going to take for us to start to, like, be able to build a community that doesn't have such disparities. So, yeah, I was at a barbecue recently down there and was like, man, I feel kind of, like, awkward and really uncomfortable. And it made me think, like, but I almost never feel uncomfortable in places. Like, that's a commonplace feeling for a lot of people, especially people who have to, like, navigate institutions of power and are, you know, not from a culture of power. I can take that for, like, a barbecue.
Yeah, I know the exact feeling. We kind of talked about this in an interview we did together where, you know, Third and Up, there's not a lot of black faces. There are some black faces, but they start to dim down, and the comfort level for myself tends to go down also when I go up there. And, you know, it's not like I feel like I'm in danger, but it's just not what I'm used to. And there's, like, not a lot of people that look like me and are gonna dress like me and talk like me. So it definitely come out my comfort zone on that way. And that's the two sides of our city.
That kind of feeds into my next question. In Hudson, many of us have been able to see past color in a lot of situations. We have white friends, black friends, Spanish friends, and Bengali friends. But how far does that trust go?
I mean, I was brought up, you don't trust anybody, no matter the race. I don't care what they are. You know, a thief comes in every color. A murderer comes in every color. So I think it really depends on the person, you know.
I think I trust everybody. But maybe that actually, maybe that is like, you know, I haven't had a lot of experiences in my life that have made me not, made me like, I've never learned the hard way. So yeah. Like, but I do think that that question about discomfort, like out of that, like, I think that's how you learn. You learn when you're uncomfortable and you learn when things are like pushing against the things you know. But that's also where, for a lot of people, like that's where fear originates and that's where hate originates, is in that place of discomfort.
How does this verdict, if at all, change your view on racism or affect your view on racism?
Personally, it didn't really change the way I viewed it, anything. Actually, talking to a lot of people before the verdict was read, a lot of people expected it to be not guilty because of racism. And, you know, I mean, for everybody to be appalled about the verdict is more of just like, be appalled about, you know, the process that allowed the verdict. Like, you knew it was coming, and we still ain't trying to do nothing to stop it. You just get mad and, you know, voice your opinions about it and stuff. But I personally was surprised by the verdict. I thought that with the way the case was presented, I didn't think they would get the murder. I thought manslaughter was going to be, you know, the charge. But I was surprised, but the surprise only lasted probably for like 30 seconds. And then I said, you know, here's our country again.
Yeah, I agree. I wasn't surprised with the verdict. I was more disappointed by what it turned into after. It turned into a lot of, they kind of discredited Trayvon, and they discredited that a young youth was killed by an adult. And it turned into, you know, why this fuss over him and who is he? And it kind of went into, you know, black kids kill black kids every day. And that's where, like, I really didn't understand, like, where this is coming from, because there's an overall emphasis that we don't care a lot about black-on-black crime. But when this happens, when, you know, there's another race kills one of our own, then, you know, there's an outcry.
Right after I went on Facebook afterwards and I was looking, you know, my news feed was blowing up with everything talking about it. And I was surprised to see a lot of people were on some, like, you know, F. Zimmerman, like, he's a dead man walking, this and that. And I thought that the anger was misplaced. Like, instead of being mad at him, be mad at the system that allowed him to walk, you know?
I don't even think it's just the system that allowed it. What, like, I think it's true that the verdict was not in any way, like, a revelatory about the system. It was kind of like a confirmation of something of what a lot of us think about and talk about all the time. But it's not just that the system allowed for a jury to come up with a verdict like this. I think it's that the system actually, like, prescribed that. Like, that, like, there's a lot of things about this case that, like, were written to come out like that. And I think it's a really, really important, like, reminder of what institutional racism really is, which I feel like is something we talk about but can feel kind of like hard to actually understand, especially when you do have, like, people of color in positions of power that, you know, like when we have a black president and we're like, it can confuse the mind when you're trying to understand how institutional racism really operates, because it can be so concrete for some people, and then it can be such an abstract concept to sort of see something like that, which is like such a crazy insight into how this thing is really functioning. I don't think it's all that dissimilar to how most of our systems are functioning in this country and in this community here.
I just want to hear some opinions on the woman in Florida who shot off 2 warning shots and got all that time in prison, compared to Zimmerman killing somebody and not being charged at all.
He had a better lawyer.
I mean, it basically comes back to, it was about race, you know? It kind of, like, there's always going to be the yin and the yang on everything. Like, it's always going to happen. And a lot we talked about how there's not a lot of emphasis on black and black crime, but in every neighborhood in New York City, there's been a march where, you know, a young kid, black kid, was killed by another black kid, or there's gang violence, there's been marches. You know, all the time there's basketball tournaments that are, you know, anti-violence. There's all these things. So when the Trayvon Martin case caught fire, you know, why not Trayvon? You know, it has to start somewhere. He is still an innocent kid, regardless of his color, who got killed. He was unarmed. You know, you can't, I've never shot anyone with Skittles or an iced tea. I mean, it is a big can.
I think there's also something, this is kind of a tangential thing, but just that the woman, what was her name? I can't remember her name. She was defending herself against an abusive partner. And I think that's a that's a kind of crime that is so normalized in our culture. That is, it's another piece that doesn't surprise me so much, the invisibility of that as a cause for self-defense and as a really legitimate cause for people's fear of their own lives. And I think there's just, like, I don't think any of this is, I don't think, well, Zimmerman also had a past where he had been accused of sexual harassment, and he had an ex-partner who had a restraining order against him, and that information wasn't considered relevant. It just makes you think about, like, what are the messages, like, what work does this verdict now do in our families, in our culture? Like, what are the messages we're getting from our legal system about what is and isn't, what does and doesn't allow for violence or allow for different kinds of reactions?
And the scariest thing is, you know, he's eligible to get his gun back. And he'll be back armed on the streets.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they said he needs it more than ever now.
Mm-hmm. In 1955, a 14-year-old boy in Mississippi was murdered and his body was mutilated after whistling at a white woman. His two murderers were acquitted of kidnap and murder, then a month later, after being safe from double jeopardy, admitted to killing him. Do you agree the Trayvon Martin case is the modern-day Emmett Till case?
It has similarities, but I think it's very different in the dynamic, and it's a different time that we live in.
Do you think that it scares people that lived through that time in the same way for their kids?
I think now this case kind of set off an alarm in the black community where, you know, kids are, they might not feel safe in certain situations, especially if you're a kid, you know, with minor education and you're coming through. And you might think, you know, this guy could kill me and he's going to get off because I've seen on TV so much and in the media so much, you know, a guy killed someone and he got off and stuff like that. So there's definitely an alarm going on.
I think the scariest thing in my eyes is that when I ask a lot of kids about the Trayvon Martin case, they really don't know. So they don't know that the severity of some of these things. Mm-hmm. I think that they should be a little more worried than some of them actually are worried.
Or they feel like it can't happen to me.
Right.
I feel like Kamal said, like, there's definitely similarities. Excuse me. But, like he also said, like, it was a totally different time in America then. Like then you knew pretty much who was racist and who wasn't, north, south, you know. Now it's almost like, you know, it's still there, but you try to turn a cheek and be, like, politically correct about it. And the media today plays, like, a greater role in, like, I couldn't imagine if the Emmett Till case happened today, how the media would take it and run with it. Mm-hmm. It'd be a firestorm, you know, like, but like you were saying too, like, I really think there's a lot of people that don't even really know the story of Emmett Till. And like, mm-hmm. you know, I feel like you should at least be familiar with something like that, because when something like Trayvon Martin happens, it's not really a shock. Like it's not an unprecedented event. Like, this stuff has been going on, like, the history of our country. It's just, it takes something to connect with a person for them to finally see it.
We're going to take a quick break and be right back.
Trayvon, oh Trayvon, my heart goes out to you as a young man, not just because your skin represents the culture of mine, but because you represent a legacy a father would never define. We'll never get to fathom nor comprehend how perception can be digested and manifested into a life and an end. From my mind, this is how the story begins. Late night, hood on, a store stop for a snack, not knowing my path chosen would result in attack. In fact, this Arizona and Skittles combo is so where it's at, is what I'm thinking. So I walk, though through parts where my kind is not wanted, and older man sees a threat and approaches with caution. I don't mind. Though I should, not knowing his heart feels, I'm sick and tired of dealing with these dudes from the hood. A 911 call where he's told to cease and desist, to him, an invader, Zim feels an ER isn't enough for a kid, man. I always hear about fights that turn into one fighting to live, but how could anyone justify the actions of men? Now, these actions could easily incite riots and physical altercations between opinions, culturally biased, but please, at some point, life has to be so much more valuable. So before risking a fight for you to live, give the fact you have life a little more gratitude, or your candy could be crushed. R.P. Trayvon, my condolences to his family. SBK, what up? Thank you.
Welcome back to Barbershop Talks. I'm here with Veronica May, Shaquan, and Tiquan Davis at TSL, three youth workers for SBK. I'm just curious, what did you guys think about the Trayvon Martin verdict?
I said Zimmerman should have went to jail.
Why?
Well, they heard the video. The guy told them, the cops told them not to follow the case. They don't follow.
Right.
I think he should be in jail also.
So, did any of you watch the case?
I watched it.
The jurors weren't allowed to consider race. Do you think that it was still a factor in the verdict?
Yes.
Yes.
Because if Trayvon was to kill Zimmerman, I believe that he would have got slapped with, like, manslaughter, and
he would have got life.
Yeah, he would have got life in prison, and so I felt like
it definitely is race behind that, because an African American woman went to prison for 20 years for letting off two shots, and she didn't even shoot anybody.
Do you guys think that racism is in Hudson?
Racism is everywhere.
It's everywhere.
Have you seen it in Hudson, experienced it in Hudson?
Yeah, I have.
You walk around in the stores, you know, they don't keep an eye on you. Like,
if you guys could teach the young kids in our community about race, what do you think would be most important to get across?
Don't let someone make you feel bad because of your color or your race or whatever you have. Like, just stand your ground and hold your head up high. Don't let someone try to break your self-esteem down because you're black, you're Bengali, you're white, you're Spanish, anything. Just keep your head up.
Well, I say follow your dream, because a lot of people be like, if you see a lot of white people doing some job, they be like, oh, can't do that. It's a white person job, blah, 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 and all that. Well, if you think you can do it, and go ahead, and go ahead, and go ahead.
They say history is written by those who survive conflicts, so we equate conquest with making progress. But look around, tell me what we really accomplished. It was written, predicted we live in the apocalypse. Nostradamus was acknowledged as a prophet, because he said the world would end. To me, that'd just be logic. Would it be too far-fetched to see what he saw? Been over 2,000 years, plunder, pillage, and war. Or are we all just pawns in a game of chess? Secret society, Freemasons blamed for the mess. An atheist to death, who could you believe in? When Zimmerman's set free and Trayvon's still sleeping. I do this for my people, hope they know I do it for them. Still on the same team, just rock a different uniform. Chance for justice was about as real as a unicorn. Not guilty, killed me, made my white skin filthy, you feel me?
Welcome back to Barbershop Talks. We're about to start talking about racism. We were just talking about the Trayvon Martin verdict. I'm half white, and I can honestly say that I'm guilty of stereotyping from experience. I feel like all white people pity black people. A lot of times I have a hard time accepting favors from a white person without thinking in the back of my mind, did they think I needed that, even with my white family. I don't easily admit my struggles to them because I feel that they think they're better than me or that they expected this from me because my father is black. My cousins don't know what it's like to hear conversations where your father doesn't think he got the job because he's black, or your father got harassed during a traffic stop because of his skin color. Or what it's like to have your mother be able to be the sole provider for a family because she came from a place that gave opportunity to get the education necessary to do that. Not being full black has made it easy to avoid blatant racism, but that doesn't mean that I'm accepted. I have a need to prove myself to both sides. I'm judged equally by both white and black people. Being mixed has afforded me many comments ending in no offense. In my opinion, there will always be racism because we've had all the experiences that we can't forget, so it's very much internalized. Can anyone relate or speak about your view on race? Starting with Sarah.
Well, that's really powerful, Claire, and I think that the piece that I feel like I want to respond to most of what you just said had to do with the idea of pity. And thinking about some of the challenges of trying to be a anti-racist, trying to confront my own prejudices as a white person, but also really trying to confront the fact that I am also, you know, operating within a system and built of a system and benefit from a system every day. I think that the piece that has been most present for me recently, especially, has been trying to think about the realizing that I too am broken by this, and that by engaging in this struggle, it's not about saving anybody else or fixing anybody else's problems, but about trying to make my own person and my own family and my own friendships human and whole, and not part of this thing that really breaks people and literally kills people. It's kind of an ongoing process for me. I think I'm probably just in the very beginning, but trying to think the exact thing that you're talking about, which is pity and realizing that, like, this is also about, you know, like, I pity every single one of us, the fact that we're born into this thing and we have no choice, but we are in it and of it. And that for my own liberation too, this is my fight. That's what that makes me think of.
I guess when I was like 6 or 7, you know, I grew up at 211 State Street, predominantly black area. I was too young to know what racism was at the time. I didn't, you know, when you're 6 years old, you don't really know hate. You know, I wasn't racist. I didn't like them because I got beat up every day for being the one white kid down there. And, you know, I guess I could relate to what you were saying about how you feel like sometimes if someone tries to do you a favor, you don't know why they're doing it. Because I remember I used to like try to go out of my way to be accepted and make them like me, like for reasons I just didn't want to get beat up anymore. But you know, I never pitied anybody because I've never been in a position to pity anybody because I really ain't never, you know, had too much. I work at Berkshire Farms and I'm a child care worker out there. I work up in the cottages, so like, I deal with the kids outside of school, like in their daily lives and stuff. And, you know, probably like 80% of them come from New York City, come from, you know, some kind of dysfunctional family setting, whether or not they were skipping school or their parents weren't really good parents and CPS got involved. And, you know, when I first started working there, it was definitely like a culture shock because they didn't want to talk to me just because I was white. And you know, it took me a while to get used to because I ain't never really had that problem because, you know, Hudson's a small town, but you know everybody in Hudson. And like I said, tying back into the racism thing, I didn't really see it growing up because of all like the school districts in our area. Like, we were the only one that was like predominantly integrated. Like, you know, you got Chatham, Ichabod, they were like 90-95% white kids when we were growing up. Like, Hudson was like, you know, the melting pot. And I had friends back then, you know, that I'm still cool with now, and it just never really affected me like that until you step back and look at it as on a bigger scale, like across the board. You know, I mean I'm sure it exists here. Maybe I'm just blind to the fact because I just never looked for it, but I mean, that's really just how I feel about it. Pass it.
In my own experience, I would say I've dealt with racism a lot in my life, but really I've more dealt with ignorance and in my life, where that gets confused a lot with racism. Like, for instance, a few years ago I was on a trip with a bunch of kids, and a group of other kids came from a camp, and you could tell it was a high scale camp. It was all white kids and stuff like that. And one of the counselors I was with, you know, looked at our kids who are all predominantly, you know, urban kids, and they said, uh-oh, like, I wonder how our kids are going to react to them when they were going over to, you know, play with them. They were all playing a big soccer game. And, like, that right there got to me, like, why does it have to be, you know, our kids to go over and cause trouble and do all these things? And when they went, our kids were actually, you know, the nicer kids. And, you know, these other kids that came off, you know, their fancy bus and stuff, like, they're very mean to our kids. And, you know, it just, to me, it set off an alarm where I can't really say that person is racist, you know, because I'm friends with them. But it's definitely ignorant. And, you know, every time you get followed around a store because, you know, your skin color is different, it's not always racist, but it is very ignorant, and that's something that happens all the time. And it happens so much that it's instilled in me that when I'm in a lot of situations, I automatically see people as racist. Like, I kind of was so happy that Obama was president and that gave, you know, young black kids something to look at where they can look on, you know, the wall of presidents and say there's someone that looks like me, that whenever I see someone bashing him on Facebook, I automatically feel like I have to defend them because, you know, I'm black. And, like, there's a lot of reverse ignorance where, you know, I don't really care about their opinion because, you know, I feel like I should defend them because he's black and I voted for him. And I just think that there's a big difference between racism and ignorance, and we see a lot more ignorance than we do racism, even though racism is very much alive.
With the piece that I read about my family, I don't think that they're racist. I don't want that to come across that that's what I'm saying, but they're from further upstate than us. So when I come around, it's like, I'm like, whoa. Purple black.
Yeah.
like the kind of black that, and I've made some choices that they probably have only seen on like MTV.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't understand. I got into an argument with my uncle about hip-hop music, how it's not a craft because all we do is spit into a mic and sing words that don't make sense. But how can you not consider something like a comment like that racism over
show.
Ignorance?
Mm-hmm.
I'm saying these are the comments that they think are okay, though. So it's like, how many times is ignorant? Do you have to be ignorant before you're considered racist?
Yeah,
even when you know you have black family.
That's very true.
I feel you, because as a white person who makes predominantly black music, stereotype, you know, I always got looked at, you know, funny, or even worse, other white people would look at me and be like, yo, why are you trying to be black? And I'm like, I'm not trying to be anything. This is, I love doing this. Like, I grew up, you know, that was the music that I listened to when I grew up. It was a major influence on my life. It doesn't mean I went out and did what was in the lyrics, but it inspired me to want to pick up a pen and be like them, you know. And I got it a lot growing up. I got it from just as many white people as black people.
I have a question for Sarah and Kenny. Sarah, you can answer first. Have you ever seen racism, like, in your life, in the community, besides on the media and everywhere?
That's a good question. I think that I have seen racism when I've looked for it, and I think it's not hard for me to imagine moving through the world and not seeing it, which is, you know, part of what I understand what privilege is to kind of like think that is to see normal all around you. I do think that the places where I have felt most kind of like directly aware of some of what is really going on in the city are in a combination of, like, you know, I've spent the time I've spent at, like, sitting in the lobby at the Department of Social Services and seeing some of the interactions happening between people sitting in the room and people behind the service providers behind the door. And I don't think that is any one person's fault in there, but that is such a representation of, like, the kind of ignorance you're talking about. Like, what is poverty and why are people poor and what does it mean to be, you know, to be like trying to navigate a system and how we get treated in there. But I also think another place I've seen it is like in shops on Warren Street, which is like, you know, I hear a lot of conversations here with and among like peers and friends of my family that feel really blind to me. There's a lot of people who talk about, you know, it can be really veiled, but people talk about like Warren Street getting cleaned up mm-hmm. over the past few decades, or like, you know, just references to what people's visions of a city here are. And I think they're pretty blind to the diversity of experiences here, and when a place is changing, who is and isn't served by it. And they're just, and I think blind is the right word, because it is, it's more, it, you know, it really is about ignorance. It's people who just don't see it and feel it, and so it's really removed.
I don't really feel like I confront, you know, too much racism in my daily life, other than, you know, at my job. But even there, like, you know, the kids that were there from the get-go, they didn't take to me at first. They didn't want to say nothing to me. But, you know, over time, I think they come to realize that, you know, I'm not, you know, like some of the other staff there. They're like pencil pushers and never been in a black community or seen some of the stuff that these kids have seen. And the fact that I have, like, earned their trust over a while and you know, learned that, you know, regardless of whatever... I feel like regardless of what everybody's been pre-taught, you can always overcome that through just your experiences in life. Like somebody's going to tell you, like, oh, stay away from them people. They're no good, this, that, and a third. But then one day when you're in a situation where you really need help and someone comes and helps you and it just, like, changes the way, like, you alter things. And as for, like, the real, like, racism around here, nah, it ain't nothing. Like, I've never personally dealt with it. I mean... I might, like, ask out, like, a dark-skinned colored girl, and she'll tell me, like, she don't date white guys. But, I mean, I don't even know if that's racist. I don't even know how to view that. I just was like, all right, you know, tried. But, I mean, it's... I've always tried to be blind to that, man. I've always tried... I know it sounds cliche, but I've always tried to judge people by the way they treated me. And if you do that, you ain't never really wrong, like... Just be true to who you are and don't get caught up in, like, perceptions and stereotypes, because they're just, like, smoke screens to make you, like, cover up what's really the real issues.
I think more of what drives me crazy also is when they break up, you know, some of these statistics, like the graduation rate, when they say, you know, how low the black graduation rate is, you know. And it drives me crazy, because I feel like some people's mindset is, you know, the reason why the graduation rate is so low is because the black kids are there dumbing it down. And they're not really as smart as the white kids. So I kind of, like, it always, like, grinds my gears a little that I feel like maybe, you know, they shouldn't really break them up. They should look at everyone as a whole. But then, you know, the reverse coin of that is, I've went through the Hudson City School District, and I've never in my life had an African-American teacher in my whole, you know, career there. And I think that would have had a big impact on me if they, being it the right person, you know, that would have been bigger for myself and a lot of the kids that are there now.
I don't ever remember a black teacher either.
I think there's also the other people, like when... The other thing you hear when people look at that graduation rate is people talk about what's going on in homes here in Hudson. And you hear a lot about, you know, I've been having a lot of conversations with people recently about learning and education here. And you hear a lot of really simple statements about, like, families not caring for their kids or valuing education. And there's so much loaded in there, and there's so much misunderstanding in there. And I think that's another kind of way that I feel like I have heard the kind of veiled racism that actually allows it to persist, because we're not even saying what we mean.
Yeah, I agree. Also, my next question I would have to say is, if you saw a white guy getting thrown out of a restaurant, what would you think? What would be your first impression?
Of why he got thrown out?
That, yes. He had too much to drink.
That's the number one answer that you would get from a lot of people. What do you think, Sarah?
Well, I just think that there's also ignorance around poverty. And so I think that there are, like, there's a whole world of ignorance we also have around poor white families and people. And there's another world of prejudice and assumptions that get made against poor white people. And so I think if I saw a white guy getting kicked out of a restaurant, depending on, you know, what he's wearing or what he's looking at, I might think like, oh, I wonder what he did to piss off the da-da-da, you know, or I might think like, you know, a whole set of things about what we think poor white people look like and act like. And I think there are, there's a lot of differences that a poor white person experiences and a black person experiences or another person of color experiences in our society. But I do think that there's this like interweaving of race and poverty that there's a whole world of ignorance around them both.
Claire, what do you think if you saw a white guy getting thrown out of a restaurant?
I've seen my dad throw a white guy out of a restaurant. I could probably agree with Kenny. Guy had too much to drink, was saying something he probably shouldn't have said.
Now, same question. What if you saw a black guy getting thrown out of a restaurant? Kenny, what do you think?
I would think the same thing. I mean, I wouldn't think that he like tried to rob the restaurant. Like, I mean, you know, like you said, like she said, it all depends on the place and setting. But usually my first thought is, you know, they did something and then it cost them to get tossed. Like, I'm not looking deeper than that usually right off the beginning.
Sarah, I know you love the world, peace and happiness.
No, I don't know. It's hard to answer because I do think depending on the context, you might like make an assumption about what the person has just done to get kicked out. But you also might like make a judgment against the institution, too, and say like, wow, look at how this place is treating that guy. I'm never going to come back here. And I think anything we think is like uninformed in that kind of situation.
Claire.
I don't know. Tell me the answer.
There's no total answer, but I once did a report on this, and I had to do a survey, and the number one answer for a white guy getting thrown out was that he was drunk. There was two answers for a black guy. There was that he couldn't pay the bill or racism. Those were the number ones there.
I would have never thought he couldn't pay the bill.
And that's, you know, the overall thought of the population that I was able to poll.
What can we do to keep our community integrated, and how would we educate our kids on race so that they understand what's going on and can think with an open mind? Kenny?
I think that we just need to tell our kids that don't believe everything you see in the media, that it's not always true, and that like they try to spark like a great debate over topics like this to get people riled up and really make them lose focus of what's really the important issues and what's really at hand. I feel like community wise people just got to take pride. It's not like, you know, your race or your background, it's your community. Like, you got to take pride in your community. Like, I remember, I don't know if Kamal remembers, but I'm sure Vern remembers back in the day when they used to rope off the whole Warren Street and have the bed races and like the whole games, everything, like, and it brought out everybody, like the whole street. You could just walk up and down the street. And Hudson has changed, and like they said earlier on the one issue when you mentioned, like they said, they cleaned it up a little bit. Those people aren't Hudson to me. Like they came in and you know, they took advantage, in my opinion, they took advantage of Hudson because they knew they could come up here and, you know, implement change, because I feel us as a community wasn't strong. We didn't have strong enough backbone to fight these changes. And Hudson is a lot different than it was like even like 10, 15 years ago. But that's because we allowed, you know, people to come in and change it. And that doesn't really boil down to race at the end of the day. That just boils down to taking pride in where you live and wanting a better place for your kids.
I think raising a black kid like my daughter is very much different than raising, you know, a white kid, because I've started telling her early on, you know, there's going to be people in your life who aren't going to like you because of the color of your skin. And, you know, you got to do what you got to do to fight through that and not let it get to you, because she's going to go through that. That's just something every black kid's going to go through, no matter who you are. And it's something that I've been through a lot of times in my life. And if you're not a strong person, you could be fighting every day. You know, you could be attacking someone every day. And I remember a situation where, you know, I feel like racism is taught and seen, so kids pick it up. And I work one-on-one with a lot of kids and a lot of different agencies that I work with. And I remember one time a kid wanted to make me mad, so he called me the N-word. And he basically looked me right in the eye, and he was like, he had the face like, yeah, this is gonna really get you. And he just called it to me, and I had no reaction. I just looked at him, and I was like, I was probably like maybe 17, 18 years old, and I just fell on the ground, and I was just like, oh, not that, not the, like, not anything but that. Like, it was supposed to be kryptonite, where, like, I felt like it didn't hold any weight because I didn't give him that power over me. And, you know, he said it 2-3 times more, and then he just looked at me like, why? Why aren't you flipping out over this? And, you know, that kid unfortunately picked that up from somewhere. Mm-hmm. You know?
I teach my daughter, I'm mixed, but she's black for the most part. The diversity is what is going to make her a beautiful person.
Mm-hmm.
Being able to accept everybody. She loves to play with little girls, not little white girls or mm-hmm. little black girls. She just, a little girl with a pony. She has a pony too, so she wants to play. She doesn't come from the most stable family dynamic. So I just teach her what the word love means and hope that for as long as possible, nobody comes to her with anything different than what I'm teaching her. I hope that she never has to experience racism, even though I know she is going to. I don't know. It's
and
scary.
That's a tough pill to swallow, because if you think about growing up in the little district that we live in, when you were in John L., all the kids played together.
Right.
Middle school, it started to break off a little bit, but basically everybody mm-hmm. played together. When you got to high school, when I was in high school, all the black kids sat together at the first table. Mm-hmm. And all the white kids, like, stayed there. You broke up into groups. So it was kind of, like, different now once you got older.
It's like I said earlier, when you were that young, you didn't know what hate meant.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't even realize you're doing it half the time.
Yeah.
Like, I don't want to say it's instinct, but, like, it's like an acquired trait that you pick up over time the longer you live in this world. Like, it's, I don't really know how else to explain it other than that.
Yeah, because there was no manual, you know. When I came in, I sat at the first table. No one ever told me to. I just sat around, you know, the people that looked like me. But I also had lots of white friends, but, you know, they sat at their tables.
Sarah, yeah. Do you have any comments?
When I think about the possibility of one day raising kids who will be, if they're mine, they'll be at least a little bit white.
Even the kids you work with.
And the kids I work with, I think that the, you know, this kind of connects to what I was saying earlier about the work I've been doing with myself around kind of thinking this as my fight for my own liberation, and like when we were talking about pity before. And I think, you know, there's a lot of white families and white friend groups that don't really talk about race because it doesn't seem like an issue. It's not something that we're experiencing day to day in the way that other people are, except for that we are, because we're we're humans in culture and in society. And so I think that when I imagine raising kids, I imagine raising kids in a family in which this is our conversation too, and this is our fight too, and this is something we talk about, and we talk about the confusion around it, and we talk about the complexity of it, and we talk about it because it's ours, and we also get angry. I was at the vigil for Trayvon Martin last week. I was thinking about rage and the role of rage and how important it is to feel heartbroken when things are heartbreaking, and how important it is to feel hurt and broken by things when our system is broken and hurting families, and that the role of that kind of rage is really dignified, and it's where struggle and organizing and mobilizing comes from. And so I think I would want to raise a family in which we are really in touch with that, the heart of it.
I find beauty and flaws in a diverse land. I find comfort in taking a like-colored hand. I choose not to look past the color of one's skin, because I have a hard time relating to someone lighter than this. See, I'm racist inside, and I can't blind my eye to the harsh history some choose to set aside. Living in harmony is a dream we attempt, but I'm never surprised when racism surfaces. It's been explained to the man, and it's said understood, but the white man inflicted the pain, so I don't know how one could.
I'm here with a very special edition of Barbershop Talks. I'm your guest host. My name is Kamal Johnson. I'm here with two very, very, very special guests, and I would like them to introduce themselves.
My name is Lauren. I'm 7, and I'm in 2nd grade.
Hi, my name's Aja. I'm 5 years old, and I'm in kindergarten grade.
And I'm very happy to be interviewing you guys today. So, what do you guys know about racism?
That only white people can go to white people's school, and black people can only go to the black people's school, and brown people can only go to brown people's school, and that's what racism is.
And it's not like that anymore, right?
Yeah.
Everybody can go to the same school now?
Yeah.
What about you? What do you know?
I know that when people like a little, like, don't like your skin because it's not the same color, that's called racism.
Very good. You guys are very smart. Where'd you guys get all this information from?
I got this information from Ruby Bridges.
Yeah?
I got it from you.
Yeah, we talk all the time, right?
Mm-hmm.
All right, if you guys were at school or at the park or somewhere playing and one of your friends was treating someone different because he didn't have the same skin color as you guys, what would you guys do?
I'll tell the teacher or talk to them and work it out.
I would tell the teacher, like, and talk to them so we could, like, work it, like, out.
Is it fair to treat someone different because they have a different skin color or they speak a different language?
No. Not really.
So, if someone was sitting at this table and they were a different color than we are, what would you guys say if someone was being mean to them because of that color?
Then you can just talk it out, and you can say sorry.
I would just talk to them and, like, say, would you please leave, like the friends, like, alone? Because, you know, that's really not nice.
Because everybody should be treated what?
Nicely. Equaled.
Good job. What else? Anything else everybody should be treated?
That they should be treated nicely, and so they can have fun.
Everybody could, like, treat it fairly.
Yeah, those are all good answers, because everybody should be treated fair no matter what they look like, what their skin color is, what if they're a boy or a girl or anything, right?
Yeah.
So what do you guys want to be when you grow up?
I want to be a princess or a pilot.
That'll be cool. How about you?
I wanted to be a nurse and a doctor.
Yeah? Mm-hmm. You, like, want to work in the hospital?
Yeah, with my mom.
Okay, that'll be nice. She would really like that. So is there anything else you guys want to say to people listening in?
Thank you very much for listening to this. Bye.
Thank you for coming. See you later.
All right, and I thank you guys. And what do you guys have to do to be princesses and pilots and nurses and doctors? What do you guys have to be?
You had to go to school and go to college and do a lot of homework and learn about the body and all that kinds of stuff.
You have to learn how to fly and learn about princesses, how to curtsy and stuff.
Yeah, you guys are very, very smart, and I want to thank you guys, and I know everybody's going to love hearing you guys interview. So thank you guys, and goodbye.
Bye.
Bye.
Thank you for tuning in. Special thanks to our co-host, Kamal Johnson, and our artist, Danielle Marby, Rainier from local music group Lost Cause, Veronica, Man Man, and Tiquan.
I'd like to thank Sarah and Kenny for coming out. I'd also like to encourage our community to talk to our kids about racism.
For further information about SBK or ideas for future shows, visit our website, www.staleybkeith.org or www.wgxc.org. Maya Angelou once said, "It is time for parents to teach young people early on that in diversity there is beauty and there is strength."
They don't wanna see us come together. Hand in hand, we can do whatever. We've been held down for too long. Now it's time to put our brown face on. It's our time, it's our time, it's our time. Yeah, it's our time, it's our time, it's our time. One time for the brother that hustles too hard. Two times for the mothers that work in three jobs. Three times for the one that paved their own way. Round of applause, now everyone say. One time for the brother that hustles too hard. Two times for the mothers that work in three jobs. Three times for the one that paved their own way. Round of applause, now everyone say.
SBK, oh, SBK.